Yes, I love it.
Sweet, he's giving me 300 boxes of grape nuts flakes.
Friends anybody ever had. And it's funny, but I feel as if I've known you all the time.
I love music, good music, but not swing. I sing.
Hi, and welcome to the Movie Magic Podcast. Each week, we will dive into a certain star and talk to some people who know much about him. I'm Kate, your host, and welcome to the Movie Magic Podcast. Hope you enjoy it. Hi, and welcome to the Movie Magic Podcast. Tonight's episode, we will be discussing James Dean, one of Hollywood's most iconic actors. Tonight, we will be talking to James Dean scholar Sarah Long and Ava Gardner scholar Jimmy Palermo as we talk all things James Dean. I hope you will enjoy it.
Hello, friends, and welcome to the podcast.
Hi. Nice to be here.
Wonderful. Thank you guys so much for being here on this show. I'm so excited.
I am too. It was very fun last time, so I'm excited to be reprising my role as a guest on the podcast.
Are we ready to talk about all things James Dean? Because I'm ready.
I am.
I'm ready.
Okay. So, let's talk about when and where he was born. So, Sarah, since you are our James Dean scholar, why don't you, further ado, tell us where and when he was born?
So, James Byron Dean, the son of Winton Orlando Dean and Mildred Marie Wilson Dean, was born on February the 8th. Of 1931 at 2 in the morning at the 7th Grables Apartments building in Marion, Indiana. That makes him an Aquarius. He is by far one of the most Aquarius people who ever Aquarius.
You would know.
Yeah, I'm Aquarius. I would know. His parents were married in July 26th of 1930, so he was conceived out of wedlock.
Scandalous.
Yeah, which was, you know, pretty scandalous for the 1930s. But his parents were pretty decently young when he was born. But he was very well-loved, especially by his mother, of course. In 1933, The three of them moved from Marion to Fairmount, Indiana, which is where a lot of Winton's family already lived. And, you know, his mom, he's especially close to his mother, Mildred, and she really planted the seeds for artistry in him. She gave him, you know, tap lessons, tap dancing lessons, violin, you know, she really encouraged acting and everything. And of course the legend is that he was given the middle name Byron after Lord Byron, the poet, which is quite fitting. So, and then in 1935 Winton transferred to the hospital in Santa Monica, California, because Winton was a dental technician. And so the three of them packed up and moved to Santa Monica, California. And that was really exciting for him, you know.
I imagine.
So from being, you know, a small Midwestern kid to going to California.
I mean, I want to pack up and move to Santa Monica, California.
I would too. Are you kidding?
Absolutely.
I want to move to Los Angeles.
Oh, so do I. But things didn't... Well, he didn't last very long in Santa Monica. Because very unfortunately, Mildred Dean died of cancer of the uterus. At their home in Santa Monica on April 14th of 1940. And that was a very terrible did I say April 14th? I meant July 14th. But, it was a very terrible day to happen. And I've heard, and well, not heard, but I read in a lot of different books the different types of cancer she died from, but I'm 100% certain she died of uterus cancer, which is probably why he didn't have any siblings. He was an only child.
Also, it very well could have metastasized, too. Like, it started in the uterus, and then by the time she died, it just spread to other places as well.
Yeah.
And in 1940, there was pretty much nothing you could do about having cancer.
Yeah, it's like a Helen Parrish situation. And, like, a little segue, like, Helen Parrish had cancer. I'm not sure what type of cancer she had. But by the time, like, in 1959, it was spread all over her body, and she was dead. So,
okay, also, because, like, that, I mean, I guess something, if you caught it really early and, like, it was a tumor, you could just remove it. But, you know, just, first of all, you know, they couldn't really treat it. And second of all, it was harder for them to find it because they didn't have all the fancy machines that they do now. So, you know, by the time they found it, more often than not, it would be too late.
Yeah.
Yeah. And at the time, one of Mildred's sisters were living with the Little Dean family. And it was a very, well, according to the census for that year. But for a young Jimmy, who I'm going to call James Dean Jimmy for the rest of time being.
Yeah, I was actually thinking about his nickname, Jimmy Dean. Like,
yeah,
that's what I was thinking.
I've always referred to him as Jimmy usually, so I'm going to just continue to do that. But,
yeah, not to be confused by our friend Jimmy Palermo.
Hi. I'm the less relevant, less important.
See, I've always referred to you as James, and James Dean as Jimmy. So,
I have multiple different names.
Yeah, but, his mother's death was very traumatic for him, as one can imagine. He kind of watched her waste away.
How
he played this game with him called the wishing game, where he would write a wish of some sort, and he would put it under his pillow at night. And his mom would come in and she would get the little wish from under his pillow while he was sleeping and try to make whatever wish it was come true.
Aww.
Yeah. And so he was sent back to California. I mean, not California. He was sent back to Indiana. His mother's body, and he was run from where, well, he was sent back with his grandmother to Indiana, and anytime his train was stopped, he would run to the back where his mother's casket was and make sure that she was, like, where she needed to be, nothing could happen to her, and
yeah,
he left a wish under her pillow in the casket. But I want to take this moment to talk about his father.
Please. I was going to ask if you would, because there are a lot of people that say he was a terrible, horrible person, and I do not get that vibe from him at all.
Let me get into that.
Please.
So, Winton Dean, he knew when his wife died that he was going to end up getting drafted, because the Second World War had started. And he had nobody to take care of his son if he was to get drafted. And who was going to take care of his son when he was working and, like, after school, you know?
Yeah, who was going to help little Jimmy Dean out?
Yeah, and according to Marcus Winslow Jr., Jimmy's cousin, who is still alive,
ooh,
single fathers were not really a thing in 1940.
I imagine not.
Yeah, so Winton did what he thought to be the very best thing at the time, and he sent little Jimmy to live with his sister and her husband, the Winslows, back in Fairmount, Indiana. And I think this was a tremendous decision. He takes a lot of heat for sending his son to Indiana.
Oh, yeah.
With relatives. And then he takes even more heat for not bringing him back after the war ended. But to me, I think that Winton did left him in Indiana even after the war ended because he knew that his son had settled in Indiana again, and he had a stable environment with his aunt and uncle, and at school, and he didn't want to uproot Jimmy again. Which,
yeah.
That might not have been the best decision in the long run, but at the time, I have faith that he had the best intentions about it. People call him, a really bad father, and acted like he didn't want or love his son, which isn't true. I know that he would visit, and I'm sure that they wrote each other, and little Jimmy would always get very excited when his dad would come, and he would talk about it at school. You know, and I know that there probably wasn't a very, very close emotional connection, but that wasn't very uncommon to fathers and sons at the time. And of course, Jimmy was a mama's boy anyway. But I'm definitely going to talk more about Winton as we go on. But
please.
So, I will, yeah. So, Jimmy is sent to Fairmount with Uncle Marcus Winslow and Hortense, Winton's sister, and their little daughter, Joan, who is his cousin. And it was a very tough transition. I can say that with certainty, to lose his mother and his father and have to live with relatives.
Yeah.
But he did not complain ever about it. He was always a very good kid despite all this. And this is where things get dark, but I don't want to not mention this stuff because I feel like there's some very important things that need to be said about it.
Oh, yeah, I think I know what you're going to talk about, so please, by all means.
So, when he was 11, was already been living in Fairmount for some time again, and this is when James DeWeard, I'm just going to refer to him as DeWeard.
Mm-hmm.
Wait, can I interject real quickly?
Oh, yeah.
I was just going to say, for listening, if you are triggered by pedophilia or sexual harassment or just
sexual assault
by things like that in general,
skip ahead.
Listener discretion is advised. Yes, skip that.
Yeah.
I'm going to try this fast. But James DeWeard began to groom and abuse 11-year-old Jimmy, according to Elizabeth Taylor's testimony, which Elizabeth Taylor has no reason to lie or make up anything.
Can you say that again? You were breaking up a little bit, my dear.
According to Elizabeth Taylor's confirmation testimony, and I believe Elizabeth Taylor because she has no reason to lie or make anything up.
Yeah. And it's Elizabeth Taylor.
Yeah.
It's not like, even if she didn't have a reason,
and they were,
she would.
He and her were really, really close, and we can talk more about that.
Yes.
In a bit.
Yes.
But the abuse went on for a while.
Oh, man.
And according to Little Boy Lost by Joe Haynes, or Jay Haynes, DeWeard admitted to convincing Jimmy that he was evil, and that's why his mother passed away.
Oh my God.
And basically, it just really traumatized him in every way possible.
I can imagine. Are you kidding me?
And he was so young. And what I really wanted to get into with this segment, or this part, was that this abuse is often labeled as some sort of love affair, or, you know, it isn't taken very seriously.
Oh.
It's just gross.
And it's always looked at as, oh, look at this scandalous thing that he did when he was young. But it's definitely abuse, and people tend to overlook it. And that upsets me very much because it should be taken very seriously.
Yeah.
And not treated as like, oh, this is such hot information that, you know, a scandal, you know. And people often talk about it as if he was old enough to consent, like he was grown, when he was a child, a very, very young child.
Oh, my God. How traumatic, though.
I know, and this really ended up shaping him quite a bit in the future, obviously.
Yeah.
And details about this are all very fuzzy. I've heard so many things about it, but everybody seemed to look at DeWeer side-eyed because he was a very unusual character for the time and place when this happened.
Mm.
And there were rumors that he would take young boys down to the local pool and have them swim naked and what have you.
Oh, my God.
What a terrible human being. Like anybody who hurts a child like that, like, especially if they're, like, considered a priest or something like that. Jesus, are you kidding me? What is wrong with these people?
Absolutely. And everybody, I think James DeWeer definitely should be held accountable for what he did, even all these years later. And he is unfortunately buried in the same cemetery as Jimmy, and that will never sit right with me.
You kidding me? They're buried in the same oh, Lord.
And his mom is in the same cemetery as him, and that bothers me. Like, the man who abused him is near him, but his mom isn't. But that's... I don't think that happened on purpose, of course. But, he was a very beloved child, and then Marcus Winslow Jr. was born, little Marky, on November 2nd of 1943 to George Henson Winslow, and Jimmy adored him. That was his kid brother at heart. His young didn't have any real siblings.
Right, so he just adopted Marcus.
Yes, his little brother, yeah.
Oh.
And in school, he did plays in church and in school, and he was a very active child. He did farm work, he pole vaulted, he was on the track team, the baseball team, and the basketball team.
I was going to say, didn't he play basketball?
Yes, he was all about basketball, like, despite his size. He wasn't a very large kid, you know? He was only 5'8" in adulthood. He was a little guy when he was young, but despite that, he was like a star player on the basketball team. You know, and he would tend to the animals on the farm.
Mm-hmm.
He would take the runt of the litter of pigs, and he would bottle feed it, which is so cute to imagine. And he was on the debate team, but he got kicked off because he would make up stuff on the spot, which sounds very much so like him. And in high school, like I said, he did a lot of acting. He took it very, very seriously. I know that a lot of kids probably weren't taking drama classes very seriously. They saw it as, like, a pastime. But he knew from a very early age that he wanted to act. And also around this time is when he got interested in racing, of course, because he's from Indiana. Racing.
Oh, yeah. I didn't
even
make that connection.
Yeah, Indy 500, that was one of his dreams to participate in. But yeah, he did competitions, acting competitions in high school that he got a lot of attention for. But, he graduated high school, and then he moved to California to be with his father. One more thing before we go on into early adulthood is he knocked out four. Well, there are different, some people say it was four, some people say it was three, some people say it was only the two front teeth. But all I know for certain is that he did knock out his two front teeth when he was about 11. His uncle was born. He was swinging from a trapeze, and he either fell or flew into something. So he wore a bridge for the rest of his life.
Oh.
For Christmas, is my two front teeth.
That was him all over. So he moves to Santa Monica, where his dad and stepmother, Ethel, are living. And he is very, he knows right from the beginning that he wants to study drama. His dad wants him to take law instead, but he is very steadfast about it. And in January of 1951, he drops out of UCLA.
Oh, rebel.
And, yeah.
Without a cause.
Ah.
Absolutely. And this is when he gets his Pepsi Cola commercial, is around this time, which is online, you can find it.
So he did a Pepsi commercial?
That was his first on-screen appearance, was in a Pepsi commercial.
Hmm.
And on March 25th of 51, he appears as John in Hill number one. It was an Easter special, and this is when his first fan club is put together.
Oh, wow.
So right from the beginning, he had a very, very loyal fan base. And in April of 51, that's when he gets his job at the CBS as an usher in CBS radio, where he meets quite a few people who he would later work around with. So he did a lot of work on the radio, lots of work.
Mm-hmm.
And like he films a bit part for Jerry Lewis and Dean Martin film Sailor Beware on September 29th of 1951.
Ooh.
Which is you can find that online too, and it's like a cute little thing.
How big of a part does he have?
It's like a few seconds, really.
Oh, man.
It's like,
oh, like you can only see him if you pause at the very right time.
It's maybe like 20 seconds, if I recall correctly. I haven't seen it in a bit, but, you know.
He doesn't have lines, though, right?
I think he has like one or two. I haven't seen it in a while. But, yes. I have my notes in front of me, and that's why I'm taking a pause because I'm reading over stuff. But come 1952, he turns 21 and he meets his future agent, Jane DC,
mm-hmm.
who will be his agent until he passes away.
Mm.
And how he got into, he got a start, was on the radio and TV. And then on to Broadway, and then into movies, but I'll cover that.
Okay.
And in May of 52, he auditions with Christine White for the Actors Studio in New York.
Yes.
And he became the youngest person to ever get accepted into the Actors Studio.
Wow.
But he ended up pretty much going a few times and never going back.
Oh.
That sounds a lot like him. And that's a lot to be proud of. Around this time is when he gets serious into doing TV.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of his TV performances are on YouTube, and you can get them on DVD. People always assume that there is so little James Dean content outside of his three movies, and that is not the case.
Mm. There's a lot of James Dean content then.
Yeah, and there are a few TV specials he did that haven't even been released to the public.
Ooh.
So,
you know,
maybe one day we will get to see those.
Absolutely. I can't wait.
And, well, wasn't he in an episode of something with Mary Astor?
Yeah,
one
he was.
Yeah.
I just wanted to mention that because I like her.
Yeah
he did.
I can't think of the episode right off the top of my head, but I will try to find it before we're done. But one of my favorite things he did on TV was something for an empty briefcase for NBC. And it's a very cute little thing. And so, but this is around the time he starts going into Broadway.
Ooh.
He only ever did two things on Broadway. In November 1953, he auditions for The Immortalist on Broadway.
Uh-huh.
He ends up getting this role. He plays, it's a homoerotic sort of undertone type thing. where he plays a houseboy who seduces this husband who's on, just been married, if I recall correctly.
I'm surprised it was allowed on Broadway in the 50s.
I know. Every time I look back on that, I'm surprised.
But I guess, I feel like historically, Broadway has always been a little bit more liberal than Hollywood.
Yeah.
Probably always been a little gay, huh?
Well, yeah. Well, also Broadway was like, you know, I'm just going to mention this. And I know a lot of y'all are going to be like, why the hell is she mentioning this woman in here anyway? But, like, people like Lillian Gish, when sound came, they went back to Broadway. Like, that's where they made their mark, is, like, a lot of silent stars went back to Broadway. So Broadway was really the place to go if you didn't want to be in talkies. But, you know, in the 50s, television was taking over. I mean, like, look at Helen Parrish. She had a great career in television. And so did Mary Astor in some parts of TV. Just, like, absolutely.
And I mean, like, Barbara Stanwyck did too, Loretta Young.
Absolutely. Like, great careers in television. Because television, they think, oh, it's going to be a fad. But, you know, people, they buy TVs and watch TV all the time now.
But, I mean, they said the same thing about sound movies, that they were going to be a fad and were going to just, you know, go away after a few years, but clearly that was not the case.
Nope.
Right, and him going on TV was a big deal for his family in his hometown. They were so excited to see him and hear him on the radio, and his hometown was really supportive about it.
Mm-hmm.
So he gets a part in The Immortalist, and he does not get along very well with the director or the guy he's playing opposite of, which isn't surprising. It's like the Rock Hudson situation, but like years before it happened.
What's the Rock Hudson situation?
They did not like each other. They did not get along. They kind of vied for Elizabeth Taylor's attention, and she kind of like enjoyed that quite a bit.
I'm sure.
But,
Elizabeth.
On February 1st, 1954, The Immortalist opens for a week-long series of public previews.
Mm-hmm.
And this is when Elie Kazan found him.
Oh, yeah, for East of Eden.
Yeah, he got scouted. And Elie Kazan was ecstatic about finding him.
Oh.
Because he was like, this boy is Cal Trask.
Mm-hmm.
And when you draw comparisons between the two of them, they have a lot in common. They both have not very great relationships with their father. But I'm going to get more into Winton and Jimmy's relationship later on when we get there.
Yes.
And they have mothers who are dead, although in East Sweden, the mother is not dead. She's very much still alive, but you know, both of them, Jimmy and Cal, are very lost souls who just want to be loved and accepted, and so on and so forth. They're kind of like wounded animals in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Just trying, yeah. And Kazan recognized this immediately, and on February the 8th, his birthday, 23rd birthday, he puts in his 2-week notice, because he's going to go to Los Angeles. So he goes to the screen test for the role of Cal, and he's in New York City, and he is tested with Paul Newman at one point.
That would have been one hell of a cast.
And that is online. You can find that. He also was screen tested with Joanne Woodward,
which is Paul Newman's wife, for those of you who don't know. Spoiler alert.
That would have been, imagine though, James Dean, Paul Newman, and Joanne Woodward in a film that...
That would have been iconic. Yes, ma'am.
So we go on, and he gets the part, of course. once they cast him, the ball starts rolling, really. They're definitely going to use him for Cal. And on April 7th, he signs a 9-picture deal with Warner Brothers.
A 9-picture deal. Wow.
It's interesting that it was, sorry, I'm interrupting you. Interesting that it was pictures instead of years.
Yeah.
Yes, I know that was something that caught my eye a while back. Because I've been researching, if you did not know, James Dean for 6 years. And there are a lot of things about him that make me raise my eyebrows, but that is interesting that it's pictures and not years.
Yeah. So, 9-picture deal. Yeah. It's like Helen Parrish only did like a 2-picture deal with Universal or something, or 2-picture a year deal.
Yeah, like how Barbara Stanwyck would do like shorter, you know, either like 1 or 2 pictures or 1 or 2 years versus the standard 7-year contract.
Mm-hmm. So on April 8th, Jimmy and Zan fly from New York to Los Angeles to begin prepping for his commute, and he moves in temporarily with his father.
Mm-hmm.
And right now I'm kind of focusing on his career, but I'm definitely going to talk more about his personal life in a bit.
Yes, please.
So, on April 30th, Warner Brothers pays him $700 advance against his East of Eden salary.
Hmm.
Now, before this, when he was living in New York, he was barely getting by, so I'm sure that $700 to him was, like, a lot.
Oh, God. But New York is so expensive, though.
Yeah.
I mean, it's still expensive.
Like, his New York apartment was one room, and it was the size of a cracker box, hand to God. Although it was very pretty, the way he had it decorated in those two round windows.
Mm-hmm.
It was like a struggling artist in New York, and like, how cool, in a way, was that, I guess.
Yeah.
The cliche.
Yeah. There are so many struggling artists in New York now. I mean, especially with the pandemic going on that's been happening all this year.
Yeah.
I mean, can you imagine all those artists that have to be on unemployment?
Yeah. New York has always been kind of like the hub for struggling artists of all sorts, musicians, actors.
Yeah.
You know. Now, so production begins on East of Eden, and immediately he does not get along very well with Raymond Massey, but he does this on purpose because Raymond Massey is supposed to play his father in the movie Adam, who is played by Raymond Massey, and Cal did not get along.
Uh-huh.
So he put this tension between the two of them on purpose.
Oh.
But he got very close with Harris, who played Abra in East Sweden, and she adored him.
Say that one more time. I'm sorry, what?
Julie Harris adored him.
Yeah, he got really close to Julie, right?
Yeah. He had a big thing about getting close to the leading ladies that he worked opposite of. Like Elizabeth Taylor.
Oh, yes. Oh, God, Elizabeth Taylor.
So, filming started on June 3rd. And Pierre Angelie.
Oh my God, Pierre Angelie.
She begins her first day filming Silver Chalice opposite Paul Newman on the same lot. And she turns 22 on June 19th, and he gives her a gold necklace and bracelet for her birthday.
Oh, look at Jimmy being the good man.
He was a very good boyfriend, from what I understand. Like, he was not, you know, aggressive or anything like that. He was very giving. Like, when he cared for you, he was very giving in his own personal ways.
He seemed like that type. You know what I mean? Like, he doesn't seem like the aggressive type. He doesn't seem like a Marlon Brando type at all. He just seems like a really soft, sweet man.
Yeah.
He was a very gentle person, which I'm going to talk more about this
Yes.
In a bit. I know I have a lot of things I say I'm going to talk about in a bit, but I will get there.
Okay.
He seems approachable.
Yeah. He was very down to earth. But his relationship with Pierre and Delaney was doomed from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Her mother hated him because he was not Italian. He grew up Quaker in the Midwest.
Yeah.
And he rode a motorcycle, which made him terrible. She just did not. Mama Angeli did not like him.
Yeah.
So I must say, Italians do do it better. But.
Yeah, Mr. What? Italian.
What, huh?
Yeah, Mr. Italian.
Prior to dating Jimmy, Pierre was engaged to Mr. Kirk Douglas.
Ew.
Right. So, like, she upgraded, but then she downgraded. We're going to talk about that now. But basically, East Vienna wraps on August 9th. And Jimmy goes to New York. He's working on, a TV show there.
Mm-hmm.
And the last time he makes a public appearance with Pierre is on September 29th at the premiere of A Star Is Born.
Oh, God.
But Pierre calls Jimmy up one night and she tells him that she's going to get married. Although she won't tell him who she's getting married to. My
sister
did not break up with him before getting engaged to Mr. Vic DeMille. Which is bizarre, but, it's an Italian Catholic, which obviously means that he must be so much better than Jimmy, even though Vic DeMille was very abusive, physically and such. So,
serves her right.
Yeah.
Sorry, I have no sympathy for Pierre Angeli at all. And I know that
I have a lot of sour feelings toward her for a lot of reasons.
Yeah, I do too.
But I'm going to try to keep it civil for the time being. But she announces her engagement to Vic DeMille on October 4th. He reads about it in the paper. And he is heartbroken, really, because, he said that he was willing to marry her and raise their children Catholic,
He was willing to risk it all for her, and yet she just threw it all away for Vic DeMille. And I'm just like, are you kidding me?
No. Like,
Vic DeMille
isn't
even hot.
No.
So, that was his first real romance in Hollywood. It was pretty much his last one. His last serious one, I guess.
When was he with Ursula Andress?
That was the Giant era. I'll get there.
Okay.
Yeah, because we're getting through his movies.
Yes.
Oh, three of them.
Now, here's what a lot of people don't know, is that he was... Giant was supposed to start production before Rebel Without a Cause, and he was already set to play Jet, Rink, and Giant. But Elizabeth Taylor got pregnant, so they had to push filming back.
Oh.
So during this time, he made Rebel Without a Cause for Nicholas Ray.
Nicholas Ray is a weird dude, too. Like, I'm sorry.
You got a story about Larry Graham?
Say what?
Tell them about Gloria Graham and his son.
Oh, okay. So go ahead, Jimmy.
You do it. You're probably better.
So Gloria Graham, this actress who marries Nicholas Ray, okay, doesn't she divorce him?
Well, they got divorced.
Looked at his son, and then she divorced him.
Well, they got divorced because he walked in on Gloria and his son
his
Tony.
His 13-year-old son, Tony.
Yeah, in bed. So that was. If you like Gloria Graham, good for you. But please note that she is a bit of a pedo. So you know what?
Quite a bit.
I'm just not here to be like, Gloria Graham's this great actress. She may be a fabulous actress, but she was not exactly the best human being. So you know what?
No.
I'm gonna leave that woman alone. But she... No, she was not God's gift to Earth. She may be a great film noir actress. She may be great in The Cobweb. I don't care. She may be great with Lillian Gish. Again, I don't care. Here's the problem with this woman. She literally slept with a 13-year-old, her own... Wait, was it her own child or was it her stepchild?
It was her stepchild.
Stepchild. Okay, there we go. Her stepchild. She literally slept with her stepchild.
And I wonder how long she knew him for. How long
No, here's the... Right. But here's the worst part of the situation. Here's the gag, though. They married later.
Yes, she married him.
She had kids with him.
And had children with him.
18 years, had two kids together.
And that's a little nasty. I'm just going to throw that out there.
Nasty.
What?
Quite nasty.
Quite. Are you kidding me, girl? What is wrong with you? Like, you're just going to go ahead and sleep with your stepson and then marry him, like, not even a good 30 years later, have children with him. Girl, what is... Girl, no. Like, I'm not here for that. No.
It complicates things just so much, too, with, like, family and, like, you know, kids. Because then, like, Nicholas's kids, like, other kids, I assume he had other kids, like, they're... I don't even know. But just... Also, if you look at her Wikipedia page under relatives, Anthony Ray, stepson slash husband, Nicholas Ray, father-in-law slash husband. Like, it's not supposed to be that way. Like, come on.
Nasty. But anyway, back to East of Eden.
Yeah, back to James Dean.
Okay, so on November 24th, Pierre marries Victor Malone at St. Timothy's Roman Catholic Church.
Ew.
In Rancho Park, California.
Ew.
Jimmy supposedly whips across the street on his motorcycle and guns his engine as they emerge from the church.
Yeah.
Drives off.
Absolutely. I would have done the same thing. I would have crashed the wedding just for shits and giggles.
I
would have crashed the wedding. I literally would have. I would have been like, oh, hey, girl. Oh, hey, you didn't bother to tell me you were engaged to be married? Cool. Well, guess what? I'm just going to go over here to the buffet and eat some crab legs and have some shrimp, girl. Because, listen, I'm just here to celebrate you, but just to let you know that you were a bit of a whore. Just going to throw that out there. I gave you a gold bracelet and a gold necklace, girl.
Miss Debbie Reynolds fearingly walked on the aisle sobbing. And you know what? If I was marrying James Dean and I was marrying Victor Mon instead, I would be sobbing too.
Yes.
I would just...
I think she just went downgraded. Because James Dean was the best thing that she ever had. Then she downgraded.
When she died, in her suicide note, she said that he was the love of her life. Oh
my God. Are you kidding me? What? Girl, like I said, I would have crashed that wedding on. I would have made sure I would have made my presence known, girl. I would have been like, yes, honey, I'm just going to get over here to the buffet and have some crab legs and some shrimp, girl. And don't bother me, honey, because you know what? I'm the best thing that you ever going to have. But that's just me.
While we're on the topic of Pierre still, I want to talk about when her son, Perry, was born. Her son, Victor Malone.
Ew.
She ain't given birth. Jimmy was out with his best friend, Luke Racker, who I'm going to touch more about
later. Yes.
They were out one night. They were just hanging out. The boys were just cracking a cold one, I suppose. And Victor Mon comes up to their table. And he says something along the lines of, drink with me. I became father tonight. And Jimmy said, now this is one child who I'm willing to drink to. He could have been very bitchy, but he was very kind. I cannot say I would have done the same thing, but,
I would have started yelling at him and saying, if your wife is giving birth, then why aren't you in hospital with her?
Yeah, about how, in Luke Racker's book, Jimmy and Me, talks about how they're both kind of side-eyeing, like, why aren't you with your wife who just gave birth, why are you here?
Oh my God, that reminds me so much of, like, Felix Jackson and Deanna Durbin. Deanna Durbin was giving birth, and they had to locate Felix, like, he wasn't even there. Like, Helen Parrish was like, where is your husband? Because Helen Parrish was the only one who was there for the birth, because Charles Laughton saw her water break on set and was like, yo, what's going on? And all of a sudden, they're like, where's Felix? Where's Felix? And he was all the way in freaking New York. Are you kidding me?
With another woman, correct?
Yes, with another woman. So there you go. Was Vic Damone with another woman, too?
No, he's just out getting drunk.
Oh. Being
very attentive husband or father.
See, this is why I despise pure Angelique. She married garbage, and you know what? I'm just going to say it now. He was garbage. Just going to say it. Not a cool person.
Towards her because of, you know, she had a domineering mother and stuff, but I don't know. I have a hard time getting past the fact that she just hurt him so much, and anybody who hurts him is like my sworn enemy.
Yeah.
But continuing on, East Vedant was, he actually saw that movie in its entirety.
Mm-hmm.
So on November 14th, he meets Natalie Wood for the first time.
Yes, Natalie Wood.
A TV episode of called I'm a Fool. And she was before Rebel Without a Cause began. And that is also online. You can find it. And then on December 12th, he did a CBS special with Ronald Reagan called The Dark, Dark Hour.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that must have been a dark hour for him if he was stuck with Ronald Reagan.
Oh, God. Ronald Reagan, that man. That's a different episode. I'm actually going to leave that man alone, because I do know there are some fans on Twitter and some fans of his in the Twitter universe on Twitter that, in the old Hollywood universe, I'm sorry, on Twitter, that love that man. So I'm just going to leave him alone.
I must say this, though.
Please.
Because since I do not like him or whatever at all, I would just like to tarnish his wife Nancy's reputation a little bit. And for those of y'all who did not know, apparently Nancy had the reputation for giving the best, what Monica Lewinsky did to Bill Clinton's in Hollywood. Apparently she was very good at that.
While we're on a political note, if you ever were wondering, James Dean's father was a Democrat.
Yes.
And Jimmy was extremely liberal for his time. He was very, very unprejudiced. He was not a racist. He was not sexist. He was not homophobic. He was so unproblematic, you don't even understand.
See, this is why I adore James Byron Dean. I adore this man, for real.
And we'll talk more about being unprejudiced when we talk about Giant.
Yes.
Let's scoot on into the Rebel Without a Cause.
Yes, let's scoot into Rebel Without a Cause. One of Hollywood's most iconic movies. I don't think there has been a film that has not touched or referenced that movie, or a TV show. There have been, like, there is a TV show called Future Man on Hulu, and they do an episode in which James Dean is quoting his "You're tearing me apart." That
Rebel Without a Cause is extremely iconic.
Yes,
I mean, it's about teenagers, and it's movie, book, TV show, song, and it's about teenagers. It references Rebel Without a Cause.
If you had any idea, I have listed out every TV show reference to him, every movie reference to him, every, you know, other famous person who was a fan of him. I could go on for hours and hours. Like Fonzie from Happy Days was based on the same theme.
Mm-hmm.
If you were wondering. Now, we're moving into early 1955, which is when he goes with Dennis Stock to Indiana, where he takes those very famous photos of him on the farm in his hometown. And shout out to Kate, of course, for giving me that lovely book with all those photos in it.
Yes.
Now, he goes, this is the last time he will ever go home. Family. He doesn't know that yet. They don't know that yet.
Only God knew that.
Yeah. And he celebrates his birthday around this time.
Mm-hmm.
And the last time he went home, he recorded his family talking, and there's some snippets of it. Well, there's one snippet of it online, and where him and his grandpa are talking and laughing, and it's very precious.
Oh.
And, but he, according to his grandmother, Emma Dean, he took out his tape recorder after this conversation was over, and he played it back, and he said, this is how I'm going to take you back to California with me, and one day I want you to move to California with me, and I'll take care of both of you, his grandparents. It's the sense of a person he was. He cared about his family so much. And they loved him very much, you know. So, and this is when he attends a sweetheart ball on February 12th. And he's like signing autographs because he's already a star in Fairmount. You know, he's a local celebrity.
Oh, absolutely. Sign those autographs, sweetheart.
I know. Oh, okay. Speaking of his autographs, I think this might have been the situation where somebody asked for his autograph and then tore it up in front of him.
What?
I'm not sure if this happened at the Sweetheart Ball, but I've heard of that that happened. Because, you know, they didn't want him to think he was such a big deal. Even though he was very down to earth. But, you know, to whoever did that, your mom's a whore.
Also, the way I look at it is this. You may be thinking bad stuff about him, and you may be, you know, all torn up about him, and you may hate him, but he's on your mind.
Right, and my friend Amy and I were talking about it, and she was like, well, you just threw away $10,000, because his autograph is worth so much money now.
Yeah, I bet that person is really,
how does it feel?
They're still alive.
$10,000.
Yeah, if you go on eBay or something, his autograph is like thousands of dollars.
As of 2010, this might have changed, but his autograph as of 2010 was the most valuable one there is.
Wow.
Yeah, I bet him and Marilyn Monroe were the two most valuable autographs ever.
Yeah, because they didn't sign a whole bunch.
He didn't have to sign very many.
Yeah.
So that's why his autograph is like so expensive. Like, I've looked just for giggles and just to see how much, oh, I just want to see how much his autograph is worth. And to be honest with you, like, let me check right now. Let's see. If I go on eBay,
last time I looked, they're all upwards of, you know, 8,000 or 9,000. Going
oh, yeah, it's almost like,
oh, $6,000.
Wow. It's like, do you want a decent quality used car? Or do you want a James Dean autograph? Do you want a new refrigerator? Or do you want a piece of paper with writing on it? Like,
like some of them are like $6,000. Oh my god.
BRB robbing a bank.
And he would sign them Jimmy Dean.
Yeah. There are some that are James Dean, but a lot are Jimmy Dean.
Oh my god.
Now, East Indian opens in March of 55. And like I said, he was famous before he died. A lot of people don't realize that. Like, he was, you know, unknown or working his way up. But East of Eden was out for a while before he died, and he was already a star. And he's on the rise. Now, on March 23rd, he shoots a screen test for Without a Cause with Natalie Wood and Sal Mineo.
Mm-hmm.
It's in black and white, and it's with Corey Allen, Dennis Hopper, Beverly Long, you know, so on and so forth, and Nick Adams. Nick Adams, when Jimmy died, he dubbed some dialogue for Giant that Jimmy didn't get to do.
Huh.
Because he worked on Rebel Without a Cause and Giant. And this screen test with Jimmy, Natalie, and Sal was very precious and cute, but it's also very bittersweet because they all three died tragically.
Oh, yeah.
That movie's cursed, I swear.
It is.
That's the rumor. Oh, and also Debbie Reynolds was considered for the part of Judy in this movie.
And Judy is Natalie Wood, right?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
And he had met her previously at his Beverly Wills, his old girlfriend's birthday party, like in the early 50s. And there's a photo of them together. but it's kind of like nobody ever really notices because you can't really tell who it is unless you know really. But he is very involved with the direction and filming of Earl of the Cause. He loved that movie. He's very serious about everything he did, of course. And like when he hit, you know that scene in the beginning where he hits the desk because Ray, who the cop tells him to, he just takes out his anger on the desk. He actually like bruised his hand and like they thought it was broken. He had to go to the ER and like have X-rays done. Which like fight scene he actually did get cut by the blade.
Oh God.
But he didn't. He wasn't willing to stop. He was a true method actor.
You know? I would need a body double for that. If it was a switchblade scene, especially, you know, I would simply say, I'm not going to risk my body. I don't love acting that much. Y'all can get it with me.
And that's why he was a very true actor. He was willing to do whatever he had to do.
That's why I acting.
You know, and really Cause is such a beautiful film.
It is.
It's with color red.
It's one of my favorites of his. Mm-hmm. Out of the three he made, Giant and East of Eden.
Yeah.
Well, East of Eden is beautifully done. I mean, it's but Elie Kazan is a genius. But that's for a topic for another episode. But
right.
I will say this. Rebel was the one that really made him like an overnight success. Like, forget East of Eden.
That one came out a little over, under a month, I think, after he died. And his death really took a part in launching that movie. Because, you know.
Well, wasn't it released in November?
Released in October.
Never mind. I'm done. Anyway, that's not really important. But.
Yeah, it premiered on October 26th.
So a month to the day, wow.
Well, not to the day, but pretty close.
Wait, didn't he die on the 26th?
The 30th of September.
I'm dumb.
You're off your game.
I really am. Well, it's because it's 99.
What it was, originally it was going to be shot in black and white, but then they decided to do it in color. And his jacket was originally supposed to be a black leather jacket, but it was changed to a red windbreaker.
Uh-huh.
Which I think was tremendous, a great decision. And that jacket became iconic in its own right, you know.
I wonder who owns it.
I'm pretty sure it was up for display a while back. I'm not sure where it is currently.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the jacket is safe somewhere, I'm sure. But
better be.
Yeah, he worked very hard on Rebel of the Cause, and he basically went and finished Rebel and immediately went into filming Giant, no break between, you know. He was very exhausted, but he pushed through, really. Which, another thing about him that really affects his work ethic, like, you know, he was always so dedicated to Rebel of the Cause that he was working, doing everything he could to make it, you know, such a good movie. And, you know, he had what he called a director's notebook, and he would take notes on how the directors, like, did the lighting and set up shots and, you know, decisions they made. He wrote 40 pages in this notebook about Elie Kazan and how he directed. So, you know, he didn't want to be a producer and director down the line, and I'm sure he would have done tremendously. Because so much of what he did was out of what he thought was best. Like the opening scene in Rebel Without a Cause where he's on the ground playing with the monkey.
Yeah.
That was improv.
Oh.
Like, he was like, the camera's rolling, and the cameras have, like, they've been filming for close going. He was like, keep going. I have this great idea. And the scene in Sweden where he hugs Raymond Massey and he's sobbing and he kisses him and then he runs out, that was his totally him. And he wasn't really supposed to do any of that. But he decided to, that was important. And so on and so forth. So.
Yeah.
Now, Giant Henry started filming.
Yeah, let's go into Giant.
Yeah.
Can I add my obligatory David Gardner comment here?
Please.
Yes.
So for those of you who do not know, MGM originally, well, wait, Giant was an MGM movie, right? And Jamie was loaned out.
It was
from Warner's.
I think it was MGM.
Anyway, that's not that important. I was just thinking because Elizabeth and Ava were both MGM, but originally they wanted Ava Gardner. Well, I don't know if they wanted her. Like, she was their first choice. She was considered, but it had to go to Elizabeth Taylor because she had to go to Pakistan to film Valley Junction, which was released the same year as Giant.
Along with Ava, Grace Kelly, Olivia de Havilland, Vivien Leigh, Reed Hayworth, they got them Hepburn were all considered.
Wow. Oh my god, so Kay Hepburn?
Yeah.
Wow.
She's too Yankee to be in Giant. I love her to death, but that wouldn't go well.
And for Rock Hudson's part, John Wayne, Gregory Peck, Earl Flynn, Burt Lancaster, Kirk Douglas, Tyrone Power, Henry Fonda, and Jimmy Stewart were considered for that part.
Damn.
And Brando, Robert Mitchum, and Monty Clift were considered for Jimmy's part.
This really could have been a movie about old people, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. And Monty Clift, I love him so much. And I could talk about him.
He makes me sad.
Yeah. But I'm glad that you get a part over him, though. But moving on.
All right, let's get into Giant. Because Giant was his last movie.
Yes. Giant started filming before the draft, actually. And he joins the cast. In June, and Roll Wrapped in late May. And Giant had already been filming since May 19th, and Rebel Wrapped on May 26th. So.
Ooh, tell the Mercedes the Cambridge story.
The one about his shirt?
No, the one with the car. It's because I think that's the funniest story.
Wait, what are you talking about? I might have just gone blank.
Well, wasn't it like he was speeding or whatever, so it took away his car, but then he, like, got Mercedes to, like, speed? And also, was it, like, she was driving and he sat on the hood and went out shooting rabbits? And
yeah,
she drove him around?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that. They did, like, he was not allowed, to race or be do any of that stuff while he was making the movie. That's why he cannot fit in. George Stevens was part of the reason why. But yeah, he and Mercedes, they were pals, you know? And yeah, he got very into character to play Jet. He would hang out with the local cowboys. They taught him how to larinet, lasso, and what have you. And they taught him how to walk and talk like a cowboy, a true Texan. And he loved being a Texan. He said that he wanted to be a Texan all the time, actually. And he rarely ever... Well, the thing is that he loved the shirt he wore, and he really ever washed it, apparently.
That's gross. I'm sorry.
Yeah. But he was the only cast member who would hang out with the locals, who would have anything to do with the locals.
Because they filmed in Marfa, did they?
Yeah, quite a portion of it was filmed in Marfa, Texas, which is a tiny little place, I suppose.
It's not that big. Bless you, Jimmy.
Thank you. Well, actually, that was a cop.
Oh, bless you. Marfa, for me, is about 8 hours.
Texas is a large state.
It is. Well, that's because it's on the other side of the whole state. It's by El Paso.
Yeah, I was gonna say, isn't it like right by New Mexico?
It is. It's by El Paso. So it's a small little city. You know, it's not that big. It's got its own little Walmart. It's got its own little thing.
Have you been?
I have not, but I do know somebody who has been many times.
Okay.
The locals loved him. Like, he would give spare change to the children who were on set, and their photos of him giving them soda.
Oh.
Just, like, autographs, have conversations with them, and just, you know, hang out. And they would always see him driving by in his car, and they were very excited because they were movie stars in their small little town.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, he was, like I said, very unprejudiced, which was most of the extras in a lot of that town were Mexican Americans and such.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, to him, these were just people. He had so many friends of color, you know, that, you know, for somebody who grew up in a small town in the 30s and 40s, you would think that he was very close-minded and such, but he wasn't.
He took a ballet class with Eartha Kitt.
Yeah, there are photos of that. And
yeah, weren't they
lovely? Yes. So, it's lucky to become friends with Elizabeth Taylor.
But can you say that again? I don't know if it was that way for Kate, too.
Yeah, the connection was a little bit off, sweetheart.
Okay. This is when you become friends with Elizabeth Taylor.
Of course. The E.T. of all E.T.s.
E.T. Elizabeth Taylor.
Oh, my Lord.
The best just buddies that there ever were. You know, they would stay up talking until all hours of the night, like 3 in the morning, and they have to get up at 7 for work, or be on set at 7. And I think he definitely loved having, a lot of his friends were female. I think he loved her motherly quality, because he didn't have that motherly love since his mother died. I think he was always searching for that in a lot of different people. You know, of course, his aunt raised him, and that was his, you know, mom.
It wasn't his mom, but it wasn't his mom.
Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, he was always kind of like searching for, you know, that sort of motherly bond and love and connection.
Yeah.
Because, you know, once you lose the real mom, there's really no replacing that.
Absolutely. Your mom is like, I can't imagine losing my mom. You know, my mom had a birthday today, so happy birthday to her.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, but she, like, she's 68, and I'm just like, damn, I can't imagine anything without her. I just can't.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, my mom's going to be 50 in March, which, that's scary.
Yeah, my mom passed away almost 3 years ago, and I understand where he was coming from with all that.
Mm-hmm.
What have you. But,
So, let's dive into his death a little bit, because that's what he's mostly known for, is the car crash that he was involved with, which was the horrific car crash. So, can you talk a little bit about that for us?
Yes. So he actually had rapped on Giant when all this happened, and he bought his Porsche Spyder that he had seen previously at a race before, and he didn't win that race, but he was enamored by this car, the Porsche Spyder, and he wanted one, and he wanted to compete in a race with it. Now, here's what I want to put in giant letters, is he was a safe driver, and he was a professional.
He wasn't speeding.
Yeah, when he died, he was not speeding. Well, I'm going to touch on that, but people always assume he was a reckless driver, and he didn't know what he was doing, but that is not the truth. Luke Bracker and him both loved racing, and they supported each other in it 100%, and he said that Jimmy was a very good driver, responsible driver. He didn't let other people knock him around. You know, Jim Backus said, who played his dad Rodakoff said that he would never put anybody else's lives in danger.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true. And yeah, when he died, though he did get a speeding ticket for only going 5 or 10 over the limit, he was not speeding at the time of death.
Mm.
And that's very important. But the crash, so Rolf Wetherich was his German mechanic. He had convinced Jimmy that instead of taking a truck with the horse rider on the back to the race in Salinas that they were going to attend and be part of, mm-hmm. to just drive the spider itself out to get, like, some mileage and what have you.
Mm-hmm. Not a good decision.
So, the morning of September 30th, he saw his father. Remind me to come back to his father before when I'm done.
Yes.
But he and Rolf set out to Salinas, California, which is kind of ironic because in East Sweden, it takes place in the Salinas Valley.
Oh.
So that was like a full circle moment. Yeah. So he was on his way to that race, and he dies en route. He is hit head on by Donald Turnip Seed. He's a 23-year-old former Navy. He says that he could not see Jimmy because of the lighting in the car was silver. He just didn't see him coming. Even though Jimmy, it cannot be held at fault because he had the right of way at the. So, his death definitely cemented his status as a legendary icon, and people were so shocked by his death in Hollywood. It was like the president died,
mm-hmm.
according to quite a few people.
Elizabeth Taylor had to go into the hospital, didn't she?
Yeah,
she was
so
restricted that she could not deal. She was
so
terrible.
I love that so much as
an
aside, but continue.
Well, goddammit, do it!
That's my favorite
record
of the interview of all time.
A little segue into Elizabeth Taylor. She was doing this press conference, apparently, or this red carpet interview. And she was talking, long story short, she was doing this little interview and they were like, she was asking them, well, do you take out money? I mean, take out food to the poor or something? I think that's what it was. I can't really actually remember.
Well, I think it was kind of like, you know, you don't have to be super rich and famous like I am to help the less fortunate.
But yeah.
As long as you are more fortunate than them, you can help them.
Mm-hmm. And so she was like, and then the guy was like, no. And she was like, well, God damn it, do it. That's my favorite red carpet interview. Like, that's the only credit I will give Elizabeth Taylor. Other than that, I don't give her credit at all for, like, stealing Debbie Reynolds' husband, but that is another story for another podcast episode.
That whole scandal, though, that should be its own episode. But anyway.
Agreed.
We digress.
Anyway, we digress back to his car crash. So he had the right of way, and he wasn't speeding. So did it hit him head on?
Yes, it did. And it broke his neck. Many other bones, it crushed his foot, you know, and his mechanic was thrown from the car.
Oh.
And other driver down from her feet broke his nose, I think. But he got
out. How fast were they going if it hit him that part on impact?
Lord, I'm not positive, but I do know that, like, the bumper, well, the front, what's the front bumper? What's the front part called? Is it called a bumper?
Yeah, bumper. Both the front and the back
front
of bumpers.
The front of his car pretty much hit him in the face. I mean...
Well, yeah, because that, I'm sure, like, a Porsche Spyder would be very, very low. So probably...
The Spyder was incredibly low to the ground. There was no roof or anything.
Oh, yeah. I'm looking at pictures of it now, and I'm just like, oh, my Lord.
It was like an aluminum can, the way his car was when the crash was... There was no way he could have survived that, you know. But there are conflicting reports that he died on impact. But some people said, well, Ralph said he saw him But he was dead on arrival.
God. He was only 24?
Yeah, he was 24, going on 25. He had just signed $1 million deal. He's going to be very rich pretty soon. He was going to do what he loved. He had his two next roles already lined up.
Mm-hmm.
Billy the Kid and Left-Handed Gun. And Somebody Out There Likes Me, which both of those roles went to Paul Newman.
Mm.
And Somebody Out There Likes Me, he would have been playing opposite Miss Pierre Angelique.
Mm. How awkward.
Had he worked opposite her?
I would like to see it.
How awkward.
I know. Let me circle back around to the thing about his father. So people assume that when he died, he and Dad were on terrible terms. They weren't talking, or you know, their relationship was unstable. Mm-hmm. And if you watch 2001 biopic, it makes it kind of look this way. But according to Marcus Winslow, whose word I trust more than anybody else's when it comes to James Dean stuff, they were on great terms when he died. And Lou Rocker says too that their relationship was beginning to be repaired, you know, which is lovely that when he died, he and his dad were coming close together again. But it also sucks because that means his father lost his son right after getting him back, you know. And, you know, but the thing about James Dean is that there's so many conflicting reports, and one might think that, oh, he only lived 24 years, only made 3 movies, and it must be easy to research him. No, not at all.
Because he's such an icon that there's so much misinformation. Like,
so much misinformation, like, you can read one thing about him and then read something that is the exact opposite.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there's so many people who you don't know what sources you can trust or not. But Marcus Winslow and Lou Bracker are my two favorite sources. I trust them so much. And Lou Bracker's book, Jimmy and Me, is my favorite. James Dean book is not a biography, it's a memoir about their friendship.
And you read them all.
I would recommend Jimmy and Me to anybody who's interested in knowing anything about James Dean. Like, if you're just starting to learn about him and you're interested, or if you've been around for a while, absolutely read this book, because I feel like Jimmy and this book is the real James Dean, is the real Jimmy Dean. You know, it is just, it shows him in such a human way, not as the star or anything. It's just like, this is my best friend, this is what we did together, he's just a normal guy, you know. And as my friend Alyssa on Twitter once put it, he was just a cute little nerd who couldn't see because he was terribly nearsighted.
Mm-hmm.
Same. And
he also sang. He wore glasses, and he would literally not wear glasses and not recognize his friends.
Mm.
There was this one time where he was at lunch with all these people, and Dick Gallows, who played his brother in East Sweden, was there, and Jimmy didn't even talk to him. And then he was looking over at him, he was squinting, and he was like, is that you, Davalos? And he was like, yeah, because he was upset, because he was just being rude to him. And he was like, oh, I didn't know that you were here. And then he got up and hugged him, you know, because he didn't really know that he was there at all, because he not seeing him. And another fun thing is that he would just climb through windows sometimes instead of using the door, for whatever reason.
That's bizarre.
He was quite a Peter Pan. But let's talk about life after for everybody involved. So, he dies on September 30th, and his body is flown back to Indiana on October 4th.
Oh, that's my dad's birthday.
October 8th.
Anyway.
Yeah, he's buried on October 8th. And on October 11th, a jury rules his death at an accidental. And on October 13th, Giant wraps up production. And then October 26th, Rebel Without a Cause opens up in New York City. And then it opens up on November 9th in Los Angeles.
So he wasn't even alive for the premieres.
Yeah, Giant did not come out until the next year. Over a year after he was dead.
Oh my God.
You know, Hollywood, as Gary Cooper put it, because he lost Ford, he's dead.
uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
But he became very iconic even then, and of course now, partly because of his death, because his death was so tragic, but it almost felt right in a way,
mm-hmm.
because of who he was as a person, to hold it fast, I
Oh, he really, both metaphorically and physically, I'm sure, he really did go out with a bang.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. And that was how he said he would have preferred to die. It was in a car crash, because it was a blaze of glory to go out in.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, guys, for being a part of this podcast episode. I appreciate it so much. You guys are amazing. And if you guys want to follow our friends here, they're at Dreamer on Sunset and East of Jimmy. If you have any questions about James Dean, please reach out to Sarah at East of Jimmy. We could always do a part two.
We should, and I'll tell you more about his personal life, and because I didn't get to touch on that too much, because I focused on his career a lot tonight, which is fine, because his career was very interesting to me.
Yes.
At least. I mean, it can be like Mary Astor's two memoirs, the one she wrote specifically just about her personal life, where she didn't mention her movies, and the one where she did the opposite.
Yeah, because despite living only 24 years, there's just so much information.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was lovely being here tonight.
I am so glad, you guys.
We'll listen again.
Absolutely. Bye. Absolutely. Yes. Okay. Thank you guys for tuning in to this week's podcast of Movie Magic.